So Goff, you know that I am a big fashion lover.
Yes, I'm aware.
And you also wear clothing.
Often.
So have you checked out Fat Bull Clothing in Arcata yet?
Ooh, you know, it's been a bit. Why don't you tell me about that, Steph?
Well, it's this awesome shop in Arcata. They have their own unique clothing print designs. They've got shirts, hats, hoodies, you know, all that stuff that you need to wear in Humboldt. They also do custom screen printing.
Oh,
so
okay.
You can rock your own design or rep for your company or your, you know, bowling team or whatever it is that you're into.
My bowling team has looked a little shabby lately, so this comes as great news.
I thought that it might. Fat Bull Clothing is at 1618 G Street in Northtown Arcata, or you can check them out online at fatbol.com. Humboldt Holding Up, the podcast where the hippie movement is still alive. I'm Stephanie McGarry.
And I'm Andrew Goff. Yes, we do run the most hippie podcast in the history of podcasts, just by sheer nature that we are coming to people from Humboldt County, California. And on that topic, last week, Humboldt County was mentioned in GQ magazine, of all places, and it's mostly not about weed, if you can believe it or not. It's it was an article titled "The Last Glimpses of California's Vanishing Hippie Utopias," and why don't I just go ahead and read this little synopsis that
why don't
the
you?
Article. Half a century ago, a legion of idealists dropped out of society and went back to the land, creating a patchwork of utopian communes across Northern California. Here, the last of those rogue souls offer a glimpse of their otherworldly residences and the tail end of a grand social experiment.
I like the voice you dropped in too when you did that. That was very.
That sounds like the voiceover
for the trailer.
Now, obviously, Steph, you and I are too youthful and vibrant to remember this era of Humboldt. But I do remember being a kid and my mom saying something to the effect of like, "Humboldt is where all the hippies went after they left San Francisco," and that always stuck in my head.
Yes.
What that is referring to. Is this thing we call the Back to Land movement. And someone who was a part of that movement and who is featured in this GQ article just happens to be our guest today.
Yes, Richard Evans, who many people might know in this community. He's also been involved in recent projects like the Jefferson Community Center. But also, he was a part of this Backland movement and a hippie, an original hippie. And he has been back and forth between Humboldt and San Francisco over the past few decades. And he has done a bunch of amazing things. He's a very talented artist, has done amazing, a very unique stained glass work, both locally and in San Francisco. So I'm super excited to talk to him today and to learn more about his experiences here and about some of the things he talked to GQ about, but also some other stuff.
Yeah. Let's wrap with Richard. Richard.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi, Richard. Good morning to you.
Yeah. Well, so Richard, first of all, I want to say, thank you for joining us today. And you are in GQ magazine.
Yes.
How is it that you got in touch with this writer and ended up in such a stylish publication?
Really? That's a good question, actually. I think it was Tommy and Karen Hessler, the couple whose house they visited, and they were turned on to him by another fellow named Doug Fur. You may know of Doug Fur.
And the 2x4s, is this a band?
No. He changed his name many years ago to Douglas Fur.
Maybe I don't know this person.
Right. I call it the Madrone syndrome.
Okay.
Naming themselves and their children after trees and things.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. These are true hippies. Yeah.
True hippies.
Very humble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh God.
So they found you and
went to visit the house of Tommy and Karen, who are really true back to the landers. You know, they came in the 70s and they haven't been off the grid ever since. Definitely, you know, raising their own food and that kind of stuff, and just wonderful people. And I live about 9 miles down the dirt road from them. And so coming home from Garberville, I would often stop because I was so tired. And we struck up a wonderful friendship. And then I did a window for their house later on. And they were always very supportive of the arts. And that's what happened. I think it's David Kramer, I believe his name. David Jacob Kramer.
I want to talk about that stained glass, but I thought, you know, maybe we'll just kind of start more broadly with what this article was about. You know, so this GQ article is called, The Last Glimpses of California's Vanishing Hippie Utopias. Mm-hmm. And what it is kind of a tour of various Northern California properties that maybe, you know, 50 years ago were these thriving experimental communes, which popped up as a result of something you mentioned, we now call the back to the land movement. And I thought maybe we could just start there. You know, there's probably a whole generation of people that don't know what the back to the land movement was or is, continues to be. maybe you could just sum it up for us.
Right. Well, yes, I also realized that too when I talk to young people. Oh my God, they don't know anything. Where were they?
Not alive. We were not alive yet.
And the recent past is the part that gets lost pretty quickly, you know, after it's in the news. But it was, I think it was the late 60s, 70s that there was a general feeling that people wanted to create their own world, you know, go back to be more connected with the land. The cities were becoming more and more untenable in many ways. Drug abuse had really started to happen in the Haight a bit. And those early hippie values of love, peace, and prosperity, and, you know, self-reliance were harder and harder to achieve. Everything had been done, like communal housing and sharing and that kind of thing, and still there was a push to be in the city and to do that. And it just also this wonderful back to nature or awareness of ecology was happening. Just about everything that we talk about today had some kind of root there. Feminism, gay rights, they were all sprouting. There was a kind of a heart opening that changed things from the 50s, which seemed like, you know, your life was pretty much planned out in the 50s. You were going to get married, have children, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then suddenly there was this whole explosion of psychedelics, exploring the personality, the beat poets, and people coming back from wars who said, okay, forget it, this I've got to have a new kind of society. So
did you just refer to it as a heart opening?
I think so. And the more I think about it and the more I see, I can't explain it any other way. It's just that
collectively
our country goes through periods. You know, we have the McCarthy era, you know what I mean, which everybody's spying on everybody. And then suddenly we had this era where people were thinking in terms of unifying and we are one. And I didn't know Ferlinghetti, but one day in the bookstore City Lights,
I was saying,
isn't it amazing that all this activity is going on? And he says, you know what, here's a shelf full of books that for 400 years were secret documents, like the Tibetan Book of the, and they're in paperback now, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, what happened? But something happened, And all this interest, you know what I mean? Alan Watts and all these people, Ram Dass, you know, of course, Timothy Leary, that was an explosion of creativity and openness and a new way of looking at things, you know.
So how does Richard Evans get caught up in this? I think in the article mentioned, you know, you were in the Bay Area.
A
lot of people who became Back to the Landers started there and then migrated north where things were a little more rural and pristine and I don't know why were you specifically drawn? Where were you at this point in your life?
Well, I'm an artist, and I was involved in political activism. I was with early gay lib in San Francisco, which was just a remarkable, wonderful time.
Mm. So, what year would this be?
This is the '60s, late '60s, '60. Okay. Let's see. Oh boy, I used to have a little calendar, but I don't. you lose it after a while. It all turns into. I can't even remember being 30.
Me neither, you know what they always say about the '60s, right?
So. Yeah, I'm right. If you can remember them, you probably weren't there. One of the best lines ever, because it's so true. Yeah. Really. But I was at the March on Washington. You know.
Okay. Oh wow.
Martin Luther King. Dilly. Yeah. And
you were in California. How did you end up making that trip?
Oh no, I was before I came to California, I lived in the East Coast. I was born and raised in Baltimore, Washington area, and New York. And I think I was in New York at the time when I heard about this. It was like 63.
Yeah.
63. And I decided, oh boy, I want to go to this. You know what I mean? It just sounded like an incredible training point. I've been following Martin Luther King, who was just like a god, you know, in terms of a truth sayer, and really spoke to my heart and what I wanted to see in the world, you know, which was a coming together of races and policies. So, zap! I got on a bus and went down there. It's interesting, you know. People think that was that everybody who was black was, of course, you know, yay! My uncles and relatives who were in the area, I thought, oh yeah, are you going to go to the march? And they thought that was absurd.
Absurd. Know? Okay. Yeah.
Because they didn't believe that much was done by kind of rallies and stuff. It was done by Thurgood Marshall. It was done by the courts. It was done by legislature. Yeah. You know, people marching in the street was like ho-hum. You know, but it takes all of that. It really, really does. And I'm sure they're totally embarrassed if they didn't go to the march now. Most of them have passed on. But, you know, I mean, it was like, it's interesting that everybody wasn't on board, you know, at the time of these things. But it was magnificent being there.
That seems like a big, you know, a big shift from you being like really in the middle of what was happening in that time, to being at the March on Washington, to coming out to the Bay Area in kind of that Summer of Love era, and then deciding like, I'm just going to go live in the middle of the woods.
Well, I'm not doing this alone. I'm with friends, and we are we're smoking dope and having wonderful, profound conversations, you know.
Yeah.
We're making kind of group, we're changing as a group, as a people, you know, as we talk and figure out who we are. We're all young and we're all trying to figure out what's going on and what's our role in it. And then it was like Stuart Brand, the Whole Earth Catalog. There was a lot of movement all over the place, you know.
Yeah.
Let's get back to nature. And so that's what we did. It was like I had a group of three other couples, and I was the only single gay guy in the group. But it was a new era for gay acceptance. You know what I mean? I really had our straight friends and stuff who really accepted me. You know what I mean? I felt comfortable there. And then also a wonderful gay community that was coming along too in San Francisco, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
that were into a new level of self-acceptance also. So they, I had a little more extra time than other people had families and jobs to deal with. So kind of plotted that I would go out and look for land and see if there was a possibility, you know. And it was not just looking for land. It was also looking for the opportunity to build our own society. Like when I started looking for land and I teamed up with a good buddy and we decided to make it an interesting trip. I said, so especially Phil, he's such an outdoorsman. He said, hey, let's just fish every river as we go north and then go visit real estate agents during the day and then come back and camp. So that's what we did. And that was one of the most wonderful trips in my life. You know, it's one of those things where you go, I'm so happy it happened when it happened. It'll never, I'll never have time to have a 2 month travel, you know, experience again. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. You know? And about how old were you at that time when you make the trip? Up to Humboldt, right? At this point, we were talking about Humboldt, right?
Yeah, we're talking about coming up to Humboldt. Yeah. Oh God, let's see.
You busting out a calculator right now?
Yeah.
So that was just before 72, because I actually was in Humboldt by 72, and so that means I was 30.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So I was born in 1942. So I was 29, 30, that kind of, maybe you're still in that age. I don't know.
I'm in my 30s. Yeah.
Oh, see there. Enjoy it. Try and remember it.
Okay. Well, and so where do you land? What's the, you ultimately do acquire a piece of land.
Like, actually, just before 72, I was already starting to commute back and forth. I was actually living in 1970, I think, in Philo.
Boonville, yeah.
Boonville, I was in Boonville, yeah. Boonling.
Do you speak Boonling, Richard?
No, I don't speak Boonling, no. Okay. And they hardly spoke to me. I mean, you know, being a black guy in Boonville in this, the 60s, I've had to have an incredibly tough shield. You know,
I say you're brave. You're very.
Yeah,
brave.
I know. Yeah, I am. Yeah, and I'm like kind of a. I learned a lot from Oprah. You know what I mean?
Well, okay. Yeah.
You're not always trying to be in their world. They live in your world. This is my world. You know what I mean? I haven't proven anything to anybody. So that attitude gets you through a lot of places. You know.
I like that you attribute that to Oprah. That kind of perseverance.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Have you become a national black figure billionaire? You know what I mean? At the same time, you know what I mean? There's all this stuff that says you can't be that. You're a woman. You're black. You're right. So in any case, Philo was beautiful then. It was a gorgeous valley. And it was interesting. But what I was trying to say is that it was not, you just couldn't just find land. I would go to places like Fort Bragg and look around, you know what I mean? You had the feeling that you couldn't really start anything new. There was just such a good old boy network and established society. It would just be like being in the city again, practically, you know what I mean? So the thing was to find a place that where there wasn't such a already established society and maybe a little bit of acceptance. And we went all the way up into Oregon, which is like, oh boy, you know, the American flag starts showing up and the right wingishness gets on your nerves.
Well, because is it fair to say, you know, like Humboldt was not as liberal or progressive, you know, 50 years ago as it currently is now. So you were coming into
certain parts of it, but Garberville wasn't. Garberville was kind of live and let live. In other words, the one of the attitudes we found in really rural places is that they, as long as you didn't bother them, it was fine. There was, you know, the thing of spacing and the old farmers and that kind of stuff. So, and the logging had happened. And so there was all this land that had been, you know,
decimated.
And so it was on the market, but there also was a large population center. So Garberville, but there was a general tendency of, hey, hippies, whatever, you know what I mean? It wasn't maybe super liberal, but it wasn't it wasn't right-wing-ish, or, you know what I mean, or against you know what I mean, and that kind of stuff. And I think I was one of the 9 blacks in the county or something, you know what I mean? So they didn't know what to make of me. And that, as I got to know people in there and I heard stories, I began to find out the history of Humboldt, you know what I mean? That the way they treated Native Americans, the way they treated the Chinese. An old timer down in Garberville finally told me, she says, you know, no blacks were allowed in Garberville in the 40s until the 50s. They were always escorted to the edge of town. People just didn't know what to make of it. You know, how are you going to settle here? You're going to marry my daughter? What is going to go on? You know, they didn't want to, you know, it was just safer to not have difference, you know, and that kind of thing was going on, you know. Yeah. But nonetheless, there was enough room for, as we know, a lot of different people decided that Garberville was a good center for activity and a wonderful place to be. And we're really, really in love with the land. Yeah, Humboldt is beautiful.
Yeah.
And
so where specifically did you, was, you know, your plot?
Edinburgh.
And the community. And the community.
We found the place. We found a place out in Edinburgh, yeah.
So which is way out. In fact, I don't even assume that most people in Humboldt know where Edinburgh is.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's out of Redway, Garberville, Redway, and then Bryceland, and then the road that goes all the way out to Petaluma through Honeydew.
Yeah.
And it is not an actual place. It's named after the Edder family and farm. But it's just a bend in the road now. I don't think it hasn't been a town or a post office in many, 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 a long time. It certainly wasn't. It was gone by the time we got there.
And so can you kind of just kind of like describe what life was like on this place that you built into a
commune? Well, we tried to pull it all together. Yeah, we had hardly any money. It took all 6 of us to make the rent, which was insanely low. I don't know, $80 a month payment or something, you know.
Wow.
We all applied for food stamps and stuff like that, whatever we could. Our houses were built out of salvaged timbers and stuff, which we wanted to do, but also, you know, it was the cost of it. That kind of stuff. And that was great camaraderie in that area, because people were engaging in the same activity, you know, and began to meet each other in town. I'm building my house. I'm on this estate, blah, blah, blah. And every once in a while, we would just get in a car and go down some of the dirt roads to see if there were any people there. And sure enough, there were. So there was a lot of spontaneous stuff happening that we didn't know about each other. But over the years, it came together around Garberville, around creating institutions, a health clinic, a radio station, a community center.
Yeah. Right. What was great about that time in your mind?
Just all the creative activity. The sense of, I woke up every day just thrilled to be alive, to be in beautiful, beautiful nature, doing things. Building my own house, you know, what more could you ask for? It was real, you know, and it was real for a lot of people at the same time. And so when you have that kind of energy in the community, it just felt great to be there.
It sounds super, you know, I feel like we have this idyllic view of that time and that movement, but like with the benefit of hindsight, were there any drawbacks? Are there any ways that you feel like you were too idealistic in that time? Or
no, I don't feel
nope, like nope. It was just perfect all around.
It's okay to be perfect. It's okay, you know. Yeah, when we say perfect, we don't mean finished. Sure. We mean ongoing and feeling good. You know,
like exciting, optimistic.
Upbeat and healthy, and you know, there. I don't know what you want to say. I mean, you know, the introduction of marijuana into the scene could be seen as a drawback for some. It certainly was. It was like, oh dear, how is this going to work? You know what I mean? It's steering our values back into commerce and money. And,
yeah, you don't necessarily mean the introduction of marijuana use. You mean the fact that this became a very industrial.
Yeah, it became it was a source of income and money, you know, and it was quite a shift from having no money to having lots and lots of money. Yeah. And how people handled that individually, you know what I mean? Mm. Became an issue. It also divided the fact that it was even before it was a big money thing, it was also a thing of it was illegal. And so that set up kind of tensions between your kids going to school and, you know, your parents indulge in an illegal activity and how families dealt with that. And, you know, how you put it out to the world, you know. And, there was this layer of having to be a kind of underground society.
Right. Did that sort of change other people in the area's perception of the folks that were building?
Sure. There was a little bit of tension there. Absolutely.
Yeah, you said before that it was so just live kind of attitude.
Yeah, you were honest. They respected the fact that you were even brave enough to do this. The people who lived in the country all their lives knew how hard it was. Mm-hmm. And but then the marijuana thing changed a little bit of the perception of all that.
Yeah,
you know. So yeah, there's an ongoingness there. But then, they came around to growing marijuana too.
Exactly.
They sure did, Richard.
Yeah. I've heard that to this day, many people still grow marijuana in Humboldt County.
This shield of not being able to be as honest or direct with, you know what I mean? People had.
Yeah. Were you growing? I mean, I assume you were growing at least for personal use, but like, were you growing for any sort of commercial capacity back in those
days? Yeah, but I never got very big. Lots of people did. They had much more energy than I did.
Yeah.
But it was wonderful to be able to pay the taxes and the simple thing, and to be able to afford as you lived there more and more, you wanted more things like a gas refrigerator or, you know what I mean,
yeah.
a better car, you know?
Well, yeah, I know you had other interests, because one of the things that they talk about in this article is how you were doing stained glass at the time. And there's a picture of you by this stained glass window. I think it was taken back in the 70s. And then a picture of you sitting by it today.
Yes, I got the date wrong on that. Window was not done in 72. I came up to Humboldt County in 72. The window was actually done in 82.
Okay.
Yeah. And as I was looking at this window, I was just like, I don't closely study stained glass, but I was looking at it and I was like, I don't know that I've ever seen one stained glass that looks close to this. Is there right. what's your style? How do you
stained glass? It's they really I don't know how to do this.
You're trying to screen share, huh?
Yeah. you guys know how to do it at all?
If you just give me a link or you just tell me what to search for, I'll look for whatever. So
wait a minute.
I'm able to see. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here it is. You're sending the, so oh wow, this is like
oh
a three
gosh.
A 3D
okay. Yes, exactly. That's what you're not seeing.
Wow.
Right. That's what you're not seeing in the
is the same one that's in the picture.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And that's just the other side. Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah,
so it's even more unique than we imagined.
Yeah,
it's
just blowing. Yeah. It blew the guys out of the water when they saw it. But they were not able to show that in the magazine. So people will know.
We will post this in the article on Loco that goes along with this podcast. So people can finally know what the other side of the window looks like.
You said it was sort of this group of you that all kind of did the style. Did you have a term for it? Did you kind of term for
this? Silicon and glass, because it was the first. Dow Corning came out with this thing of creating a silicon that would actually stick glass to glass on end. Nothing had ever been able to do that before. And we wrote to them and asked them about, you know, what were the specs on it, because we were doing artwork and we wanted to know something about longevity. And they said, well, things shows about 10 years or so, our the aging studies, you know what I mean? They take a piece of glass and glue and set it out on the Mojave Desert and see how it acts. But then they upped it to 20 years, and they kept sending us updates, and they said, well, it looks like it'll last for 30 or 40 years. And so we said, well, that's good. You know, that'll work.
Yeah, I mean, it looks very fragile. I'm amazed that it has lasted, 40 years now.
I know. Yeah. Some of it is very fragile, but some of it's very, very strong. Because once you get a geometric shape, it's like anything, it goes rigid.
Right.
Yeah. They've taken good care of it also. But this was an experiment to see. And then lo and behold, it's been 35, 40 years?
I mean, Richard, it's kind of, you used to do work like this, and now you don't do this kind of work anymore. And that seems, I don't know, I'm a little sad about that. How do you defend yourself?
Right. One must go on. It's not always easy. You know, it's hard to go back to the land and build a house and grow your own food and do stained glass.
Yeah.
Three-dimensional stained glass, just getting glass down the road was,
Right, yeah, those Southern Humboldt roads, my goodness.
Holy cow, I can't tell you the packing and stuff that, is required.
Yeah.
So do you miss it? Would you ever return to trying to make stuff like this?
No, not really.
That chapter has closed.
Chapter is sort of closed, and unless physically, I'd have to have a team, and I would point and tell people to do that. You need assistance at a certain age.
Yeah.
But
well, yeah, those are really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, for sure. I thought you'd enjoy it.
Yeah,
really beautiful.
I'm gonna do.
Were there many other pieces?
It's hard to say. Yeah, most of them were small decorative things. I did a lot of stuff for fairs. I did showcases and just small cases for other objects and artists, and I did some cases for a store that sold minerals and gems. But those were like clear cases and stuff like that. And I did a lot of things for houses. Not a lot. I did a few.
Sorry, you said you had done that one at the place in San Francisco. A center.
I shouldn't have mentioned it when I'm a naughty boy. Okay. So here I'll show it to you. It's another blow your mind kind of thing.
I was just curious if it was still there.
It is not. Yeah, then that's the one with the huge story. Yes, I did with a group of the people that originally worked in this, my friend Kim Hick and Lou Galletti and Dick Jensen and Janet Besser. We formed a group called the Stellar Arts Collective, and we won an award to do the entrance to the State Office Building in San Francisco. And we did a stained glass entry. You actually walked right through the window, and a chandelier, which is a shape we don't think that anybody's actually done. It's in books on geometry, but we don't think anybody has actually built a icosahedron. But we did, and we did a ceiling that was made
here
out
it
of,
is. You just arrived on my screen.
Okay, great. Let's so see. There.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. The
center so that is door. That is a that those are that's a doorway.
That's a doorway. Yeah. That's
yeah.
A doorway.
Okay.
We put
yeah.
white paper up in order to photograph it. Because when you're there, it's a little more translucent. You can see who's coming through the doors because the doors swing both ways.
Sure. Wow.
And we talked the city into doing that. An average of 1,000 people an hour going through those doors.
Yeah. What was this building? This was
the State Office Building at 455 Golden Gate Avenue, right across from the Federal Building.
Okay. And, this, so just the state of California's state office in San Francisco. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Oh, for sure. And there's like 10 other pictures that you would just go, oh my God, I can't believe this.
Yeah.
The inside of the lobby ceiling, when we got the commission, we just were so overjoyed. And we decided to go and look at some of the great lobbies in San Francisco. You know, and we wanted our building to be in that tradition of beautiful. Obviously, you know, what is a skyscraper? It's a lobby, and there's a whole bunch of offices upstairs. You know, but what, you know, the Chrysler Building in New York. You know, the famous buildings. It's the gorgeous lobby. You know, and the marvelous architectural details on the outside. The offices are like stacked up file cases. But so we went and looked at some of the beautiful, beautiful lobbies and decided we wanted to do ours with materials that we figured it would take them about 30 years to discover what we had done. The window is called The Power of the Sun, and it was dedicated to solar energy. And in those days, when you talk about it, they go, oh, does that work? There's solar energy. Does that work? Really?
As that article mentions, the Back to the Landers were early adopters of solar technology.
Yes, exactly. In fact, ARCO wrote to one of the fellows, the power company in San, oh, I can't think of it, was David Katz's company.
I'm aware of David Katz. Yeah.
Darn it, what is the name of it? I can't think of the name of it, but... The slogan, of course, was power to the people.
Sure. But,
God, you know what I could really go for right now? Fat bowl
of ice cream, I assume, is what you're talking about, because that's what I know that you love.
Well, I do love ice cream, but you didn't let me finish.
I'm always cutting you off.
Steamrolling me all the time. I was going to say, if you would shut up for a second, a fat bowl clothing item or other piece of quality Humboldt merchandise, because I was talking about Fat Bowl, FATBO. The clothing company in Arcata.
Right.
Yes, they sell custom clothing, art supplies, gifts, and accessories. And you know what else, Goff? They also have disc golf supplies. I know how much you're into disc golf.
You know me. I love to rattle some chains. Is that what they say?
I think that that's a thing that they say.
Yeah. And if they don't, they should.
I'm pretty sure that's a thing they say, but maybe we can go ask them over at Fat Bowl Clothing, which is
Bro, you want to go rattle some chains?
Fat Bowl Clothing is on G Street in Arcata. They're right across the street from Northtown Coffee, or you can check them out online, fatbol.com.
Do it. So you're out there in the woods and you're making your stained glass, and it's you, as you described, this kind of, you know, perfect ideal time. But now these days you live in Eureka. So when did the dream of the out in the woods commune kind of go to the wayside, and how did you arrive to where you are now in Eureka?
Well, the commune idea, ours was just kind of a commune of trying to explore mutual interest in a general way. The communes that have lasted or the strongest are usually built around some kind of larger principle and stuff. We didn't have that, you know what I mean? A spiritual idea, a spiritual practice, that kind of thing. We were more just a group of people trying to pool our efforts and, come up with something.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any kind of driving agenda underneath, and so what happened is that people met other people and started marrying them. In my own case, I decided I really needed a partner. I really wanted to be more in a relationship. It was very hard being alone, in terms of, you know, just doing stuff. And so that's what I did. I went back to the city for a little while and did this commission for that's when that window happened. And met a partner and talked him into going back to the country.
Yeah,
he was ready. He was. He was
yeah.
Just, And so we came back in 1980, 81, and settled on the other extreme, Alder Point.
Right.
Yeah. And so as far as I was from Garberville in terms of Edisburg, I was just about as far in Alder Point.
Yeah. And yeah. then why Eureka? What drew you into the metropolitan center? Yeah,
right. My partner died, and his mom also lived with us. We had a wonderful. His mother was a wonderful, wonderful woman. Her name was Fonny, and she just couldn't live in Ohio anymore in the winters and stuff. And she asked, "Could she come and live with us?" And we said, "Sure." You know?
Yeah,
and. She was like my right hand for gardening and stuff. She was in her 80s. So she lived in rural farm, you know. She knew how to can. She knew how to store, you know what I mean? She knew all that kind of stuff. So she really made the garden and things work by her life. But as my partner was dying, she felt that she should go live with her sister. And in fact, her sister... wanted her to come live with her in Memphis. So she went to Memphis. My partner died, and I found myself there alone for a while. I tried to hold on for a while, and I think I stayed with... He died in 95, and I came to Eureka in 2006.
Wow. And, so you lived out in Alder Point by yourself for 10 years?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tried to make it all work, and then it was like, this is too much work for one person to do. It's like so difficult. Yeah. Plus, also, I was getting a little tired of heat. You know what I mean? I could feel climate change long before a lot of people could feel climate change.
You mentioned that part of the reason you went back to the city was. Feeling like you wanted to have a partner. And
I made a list, actually, and I sat down and I wrote out a thing. I said, okay, what do I want to do? You know, because I've been in and out of cities all my life and country. I'm a country city kind of person. I'm not a suburbanite, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's the only place I don't understand it. But I love being in the city or out in the country. I've always gone on hikes. When I lived in the city, I went on a lot of hikes and a lot of nature stuff. You know, it goes back to my Boy Scout days. I've always always loved nature and always loved the city.
I know. I'm the same way. But you say, you said that it was lonely and difficult. I mean, even though you had support, back in the commune times of being, a gay Black man in Humboldt. Yeah. I think in the article you say like the only gay Black man for 2,000 miles or something, which
it felt that way. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I didn't meet other gay people, but they were all a couple already, you know what I mean?
Right.
And they were wonderful. And as we know, there's a vibrant gay community. It goes up and down here
Eureka. I was going to ask how that experiences for you now, compared to
wonderful. It's just wonderful. I'm out of the feeling of wanting to be coupled. I had that experience, and I'm at an age where other things are more realistic and important for me right now. I'm in my testosterone 30s, that just wasn't enough, there wasn't any, and it was time to get back to the city. I was a little bit getting tired of the straight world is macho males, they have their conversations, they have their interests, and as a gay man you get a little bored after a while.
But do you feel like there's been a shift in that? Do you find that less at all now than in the
I'm not in that age bracket or group,
right?
So it is different. I'm not sure. you know. Yeah. But no, there's no. Things have gone on. The next generation is much more accepting of gay. Gay and straight, yeah. You know what I mean? It's whatever your thing is. People are not uptight or demanding that, you know, I am not gay, you know, this kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, they don't care. You know, they understand that it's not a threat.
Yeah. And you feel something. And you feel in Humboldt County now, you have a sense of community, and so being a gay black man in Humboldt
I've
is not.
I've seen those battles. Yeah, and being a black man, it's still a bit of a thing, you know, a bit of a. I don't know if it's a novelty. It's not a novelty, but it's just that you're a real minority.
Sure.
You know, and but what does that mean? You know what I mean? And it means that you will be asked to represent, and your opinion will be asked for. It means a lot of good things, you know.
Right. So something else I wanted to ask you, you know, like as a result of, you know, this pandemic we've all been suffering through, you know, we've heard a lot of talk about the rise in remote work and how it is allowing a lot of people to want to flee cities, to live in places like Humboldt. And I wonder if you see parallels between, you know, the back to the land movement and the current migration we're witnessing. Like, is there any part of this new generation's hunger that's similar to what you experienced?
I'm not sure. Is there a movement?
I think a lot of people, you know, during the pandemic,
there's a lot of talk. But is it happening? Are people actually?
I think I know people that, you know, that they're able to do all of their work online. Mm-hmm. The cities got kind of dark during couple of years.
I know of all kinds of incidences. One couple, they left a job in New York, you know, when they closed down and said, okay, you don't have to come to work. And they went, okay, cool. And then they had parents that they needed to take care of in Idaho. And they went there and they were able to do their work and send it all in, you know what I mean, remotely.
Yeah.
And so they decided to buy a house there and see how that would go. And then suddenly the office called and said, okay, come back now. And they went, we've got to explain to you what's happened to us. You know what I mean? So people have moved out from centers. I know that, but I didn't know how much of that was happening here because I've had a friend who's been connected with the new cable coming through. But I don't think that's going to have any effect locally in terms of. You know,
we only have so much housing stock up here. But I think, you know, there is kind of this. We've talked about it on this show before. Kind of this, you know, new kind of weird gentrification coming that you know, as the price of housing up here. It just gets harder for people that have been here to actually stay here because there's this there's these people from other parts of the state that desire to live in Humboldt. Yeah,
right. I didn't know that there was, but maybe you know you've got your finger on the pulse here. There are a noticeable influx of people who are coming here because they can work remotely.
Yeah, I think you're starting to see it. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's grand. Yeah. I think that's the way that it's going to go, not just here, but everywhere. You know, as the technology, as the Zooming happens, and I'm sure it'll get refined. We're probably someday wearing three-dimensional glasses. And, you know, my dream is we will hold conferences in giant halls, you know, dressed in incredible costumes and have avatars and, you know, drag large amounts of fabric behind us, you know what I mean? And sit on thrones and make decisions.
Okay.
And the chat rooms will go off to the hot pools of another planet, you know.
You have regal ambitions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so, it's going to get better. And remote is definitely, you know, travel is going to be far more for leisure than for business, I think. And yeah. People are going to, that's a great freedom to be able to live where there's beautiful nature and stuff and not be in a city.
That's another thing that, you know, and a couple of people that Andrew and I have talked to on this podcast that are kind of new generation farmers We have mm-hmm. also seen that during the pandemic and just a lot of the things that are going on socially in the, over the last couple of years, you know, you said something earlier about that what made people want to go back to the land was, you know, just this desire to make the world that they wanted to live in.
Yes.
And yeah. I think that we're seeing a lot of that right now too.
Okay.
We've just seen a lot of people reevaluate their lives.
Marvelous.
And sort of be like, is this really what I want to be doing? Mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. know, and there's just yes. been something about this time where people have had a chance to step back a
re-evaluate.
Little bit and reevaluate. Yeah. Yeah. Right, and we're seeing the some idea, people here do that in more farming.
Very good. I didn't know that. That's a wonderful, I'm glad that there is, because I'm of course working with the community center in Jefferson. And when we talk about the larger picture, it's that community is everything.
Yeah.
You know, and having a sense and being in community and having a sense of being able to contribute, you know what I mean? When you're just in large cities and you're floating and you're just maintaining for yourself, at a certain point, it just feels empty, you know, and also it's scary. You know, you need community because when things get rough, the people right around you immediately are the ones you are going to be able to interact with and create and solve your problems, you know, create solutions and do things on a local scale. So, yeah, I'm glad to hear that people are reevaluating and electing for community. And,
yeah.
Well, there's something about Humboldt that just historically and presently just always seems to draw these kinds of people that are, mm-hmm. you know, maybe, yeah, wanting to experience a style of life that is maybe not what they see reflected in the dominant culture.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And the spacing gives them an opportunity, you know, the more spaced out, the sense of space and the sense of
right.
Yeah, very nice indeed. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
But that does resonate with the people who came in the 70s. It was for the same kind of reasons, you know what I mean, to explore being individuals and in community at the same time. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You brought up the
fabulous creativity, though.
Oh, you brought up, Richard, the Jefferson Community Center, and I'm really glad that you did, because that was something I wanted to talk to you about. I know that you're involved in that, and for folks who might not be familiar with it, it's basically this group, the West Side Community Improvement Association, basically, you know, turned, this is an oversimplification of the process I'm sure that you went through, but turned of an abandoned school into this community center that now has classes, a bike library, a community garden, a playground, childcare services, among other things. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, your involvement in this effort and you know, how?
That was a great simplification. It was perfect.
Okay.
it's absolutely perfect.
Good job, Steph.
Okay. Yeah, I wrote about it a little while ago.
All right.
At some point.
Yes, been a great story of how people came together to turn a situation that they did not like. People were really appalled that the school district was going to close down Jefferson. It was at full capacity. And the nutrition program was quite important to the area. And so that kind of spurred people on to say, what can we do? And it's a long process of being involved with City Hall and that kind of stuff. But finally, we decided that we were going to purchase it. And just as we were about to do something so drastic as to try and come up with that amount of money, we won a grant, and that saved our butt and allowed us to buy the building and begin having the kinds of programs that you mentioned. I don't have kids myself, and sometimes I don't realize the full depth of it, but I was in Grocery Outlet, and I was wearing a button. We have some nice buttons that say I'm in for the Jefferson. It's a symbol of the Jefferson School. Uh-huh. And she saw that and she grabbed my arm. And she says, I could not have this job if it wasn't for the after school program, because she works until 5. The school's got to be 3. You know what I mean? You know, and I realized, oh, yeah, that's why after school is important. It fills this little niche, you know what I mean? And it allows people to work and all kinds of things. So I'm always being educated about how important community is and how community centers work.
Yeah.
The COVID has really put a damper on us so bad.
I was going to ask what has been happening.
Oh God.
There?
Oh, parents are about to kill their children, you know. There's no place for them to go to get socialized, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's another thing that I hadn't realized. It was like, you know, people calling up in desperate, when are you starting up? I'm not used to being a 24/7 parent, you know what I mean? The community center is a wonderful place for the socializing that kids need.
Yeah. Does it have any of the programs, or are they running now again? Or is it just kind of remain closed?
Really can't run. We had a little window there. We do what we can outdoors. We do have outdoors. We have little gardening things that happen. People can pull off events, you know, that work, but it's nothing like what we'd hope. We have a large building program, a building program of training people to be in the building crafts. And I don't know if you know about that. We're going to turn a building downtown, the one across from the shanty, which is affectionately known as the Heroin Hilton. And it's going to be, I was trying to do it, make it into a hostel.
But, I've heard about this. I didn't realize that the same folks behind it.
Yeah, same folks. And we consider that part of the West Side. And it is, we're not trying to own buildings or anything. We're trying to create community and support programs.
You're good at it, so you might as well put your energies toward it.
Here's another opportunity. So we've been having wonderful exploratory meetings with the community that's there. There's a lot of artists along C Street, and you know what I mean? And that kind of hub, and everybody seems to be jumping on it and thinking it's a great idea. Yeah. But it also is a means for the program of training people in the building trades. And this will be the third one. We've done 3 of these now, and that really works. And people are being hired even before they finish the course.
Mm.
So those kinds of training courses, the children's programs, are all part of the center. The center is mostly about what kind of programs we can bring to the community. Mm. You know what I mean?
And I was going to ask you, you talk about working with the local artists. You used to write a regular art column for the North Coast Journal. I know you're still pretty plugged into the local art scene, especially in Eureka. And there's lots going on. And I was wondering, like, what are you seeing out there that you like or that gives you hope as far as arts-related activity?
Oh, well, there always is lots going on, even when there's seemingly nothing going on. It's the COVID again. This has been a terrible blow to galleries and display spaces. But the artists, I call them the working artists, are finding ways. A lot of wonderful sharing on Facebook, and I'm sure other media, I'm not always up on it, but people are finding ways to get their work out. At the community center, we've sponsored a set of murals with Blake. Am I going to say his last name right?
Ritter. Regan.
He prefers Regan.
Regan. Regan. Blake Regan. Blake Regan. Yeah. Blake is a wonderful artist and a good organizer, and so he has pulled together about 5 or 6 other artists. I think I'm not sure the exact amount to work on a mural that's almost a block and a half long wall that we have at the community center. So we're really, really proud of our integration of art into the community center. It's not an afterthought with us. It is on the forefront.
I think that's one of the great things about Jefferson is, like, you know, when if you approach it from any of the side streets, it just pops. You know, you're just like, oh, you, I yes, cannot, I cannot exactly. ignore this building. And no, whatever is happening here is good.
Yeah, and we're going to use art to solve problems. For instance, we have a water catchment system on the roof. You know, we're very proud of our solar trip. We have lots of solar panels and adding more all the time. But we also have a water retention where all of the water off of all the roof surfaces go into tanks because they're connected. Downspouts are all connected to tanks. But the tanks are painted the same color as the building. And we talk about them and people go, oh, really? I don't, where is that? So we got so tired of people not noticing our water catchment system. So we asked Blake if he could paint one of our tanks. And so he did. He turned it into a tip of the hat to Andy Warhol. And it's a big, giant
soup can.
But instead of Campbell's soup, it says Jefferson Flower Doodle Soup.
Yes, that's right. I saw that.
The exact lettering and the exact color of all
He's good.
It. Yeah, it's good. And it does what we need to do. We can now talk about our catchment system because everybody's seen the soup can, you know.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's really, really clever and good. And we enjoy that. We have some major pieces. Well, we have a major piece of tie-dye in our assembly room, which is really, really quite beautiful. It's rather large. And we have Nanananda's one of his early murals. And we always incorporate the kids into them. And Blake is going to do that also. There's going to be spots where you'll have the kids come in and do some final pieces in the far end of the mural.
Yeah. Wow.
I was trying to do that. So we integrate and you know what I mean? One thing leads to another. There's English Express, which is not happening now, but was happening, and that's English as a second language. Mm-hmm. And lots of things can happen, like an exercise program that was mostly attended by Latino women after work and in their spare time. And the reason they could have it at Jefferson is because we have an indoor play space. So they can have childcare. So by having a kitchen at Jefferson and an indoor play space, you know what I mean? And we're talking quality stuff
it's
here.
Great. Okay? I mean, that, no, it's such an amazing project. It's the kind of place that people want to live in that neighborhood because that.
Well,
is
that's.
Their-
That's the idea. Yeah. We're not looking toward Andrew, your gentrification people.
Andrew, your gentrification people.
I take no ownership over these people.
Okay. But they're welcome to come join us, you know. Yeah.
The hippie dream is alive and well at Jefferson Community Center.
If you want to call it a hippie dream, I'll stand up for it.
Okay.
Hippie gets pushed around so much, but you know, I heard that. I'm sure you've heard it. That hippie is an acronym for highly intelligent people pursuing infinite enlightenment.
Okay.
I'm so tired of hippie being synonymous with loose
it's become something of a pejorative lately.
Yeah. Pejorative.
Right.
How dare them?
Respect
them. It represents so many of the little sprouts we were talking about, a women's right and a gay lib and and examining race and caste. You know, all those things are under the hippie thing, but they want to turn it against you and act as though you're flaky.
Yeah. you got your head up there in the clouds with all your idealism thinking you can change the world.
Talking about utopia and happiness. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
get back down here and talk about
Get with capitalism, man. Come on. There was one other thing I wanted to talk to you about that I think you mentioned a little bit earlier, Richard, was that you were part of also founding K-Mud, which is
K-Mud
become just a very big part of the community.
The
hippie dream lives on there as well.
Yes.
The hippie dream lives on there as well. One of the few. I mean, I think it's like last time I went to a radio conference. They were talking about, you know, there's only about 12 or 14 stations in the United States that are really community owned.
Yeah.
The rest of them are, you know, the community stations, but they're not community owned. They're through colleges and all kinds of things. And, you know, so yeah, that's another wonderful achievement. Jimmy Durschlag is one of the people I'm thinking of, and a core of people in Southern Humboldt got the idea rolling. It takes years, you know, to do the paperwork and get it going and to raise the funds before it even appears, you know, and then we finally got the little radio station going, and it had enough power to send the signal to the opposite end of Garberville. So we're running up and down in our cars trying to get the signal, you know what I mean? Like, we got it, you know? So people don't realize it takes those little tiny beginnings, yeah. You know? They'd only reach to the end of town for a while. And and now, voila, you know, we have a whole network of stations and repeaters and stuff like that. And then it's amazing that it's gone on. But it's going on because there's still a need, you know. The radio is makes an enormous difference in a rural area. It made it possible for us to communicate, you know. It would have been horrible getting through that whole marijuana wars, and you know, without it, and of course for fire, for safety, for community, plus the quality of the programs. You know, when we first started, came on, the people in the know in radio said, "Oh yeah, well you'll just, you know, you'll subscribe to NPR and you'll do, you know, like most of the shows will come from there, and you'll just stick in a few." And it's turned out to be the opposite. 90% of the shows are done by people there. Their own personal record collections and that kind of thing.
It's amazing what they do. It seems a little bit like there's it's like herding cats down there. There's so many people that have so many shows, and it's amazing to me that place runs. It's smoothly.
Well, I'm hoping that it'll slowly get endowed, you know what I mean, as people you know, have a little extra to put aside, and please, you know, support the station long range and not get involved in the ups and downs of politics. But look at the long range advantage of having local radio. As we can see, this is a terrible thing that's happened with KHSU. I mean, just put a dent in the community fabric. Yeah. I'm hoping that somehow it'll come back.
Yeah, well, they're doing that thing at the Arcata Playhouse now. I think a lot of people that were of the crew that were putting energy into
there, you go,
KHSU,
and they're back to having the, you know, that signal only reaches so far. You know what I mean?
But they're doing it online. Yeah. They're doing it online now, Richard.
There you go. The new technologies come in.
Humboldt Hot Air. If people want to check
you.
That out.
Okay, great. I didn't know about that. Yeah. Great. I have to keep up. You know. Yes, indeed.
I wonder, Richard, you know, with you saying that, like, the Jefferson Center isn't able to do a lot right now, and you know, just during COVID, what have you been focusing? Where have you been focusing your efforts, or just your time and energy?
Staying in.
You just taking a beat. You
know. Yeah, I think we all are. Well, you know, sometimes I don't want to admit how much I'm in. And there, it's been a little break here for a while. I got to go out to a restaurant. I was like, oh my God. And I went to a concert for the first time. A classic concert, Awadajin Pratt. He's one of the few Black concert pianists on tour. And he was with a trio, and the Eureka Chamber or so, club or organization, I don't know what they call themselves, they sponsored top people coming through, you know what I mean? Just like the Redwood Jazz Alliance does. Mm-hmm. And you catch them before they become too great. He's not coming back through here, you know what I mean? The bookings now say things like Paris in September, you know. That was I thought, oh God, if they can pull it off, and they pulled it off. They pulled off. They told you had to show your card. Dress warmer, because all the windows and doors were going to be open at the church. And then they spaced us out on the pews, but it worked. You know what I mean? And it was, everybody was just really thrilled to be at a concert. You know, it's in the the person introducing the concert said, you know, it's been 20 months since we've been able to be together, kind of thing. And it was a stunning concert, and everyone was so pleased. So I said, you know, when that happens, then you realize, oh, that's what I've been missing. Oh, yes, that's what's not in my life anymore. And I'm sure for you guys, it's a ton of music that happened in this town. And, you know, and of course, the art scene was like, oh, my God, the loss of art's alive and that kind of thing.
It's been interesting. It's another thing that is causing us to have to, you know, renegotiate and reevaluate. Because, you know, I think there are things that we lost through this pandemic that maybe are not coming back. And, you know, I mean, that's it's part sad and it's part okay, maybe too. You know, just to have these events that kind of wipe clean and cause us to reimagine and come up with things for the next generation.
Yes, we are going to do that. You know, we do have a little history to show. People get impatient, but if they read a little bit, especially what 1915, 1916, the epidemics that happened then with the with smallpox and so forth were even worse in many ways. You know, I was looking at some historic pictures of people in Humboldt at that time, at the turn of the century, all wearing masks. And one of them was quite fun. It was a country family, and it was a local, I don't know what town it was, and maybe Ferndale. But the whole family was wearing masks, and they had a mask on the kitten that they were holding. You know, even the pet had a mask on. You know what I mean? You know, it's nice to see that. That, you know, we think of people in another era as not having much sense of humor or anything. You know?
I think.
You know, so it was kind of cool. You know, but they went through it. You know, and it was even worse, really. You know, the vaccines were not there. Hundreds of thousands of people died. You know. But this is not new for the world. I mean,
no, we're doomed to repeat it, as they say.
Well,
Richard, we're you know, getting to the point where this is about the time we have a lot of these things, but I wanted, you know, just to ask you, is there anything else that you know, is going on in the world that has your interest, or that is anything else you'd want to say to Humboldt?
Well, gee, I don't know what to say to Humboldt.
Everybody in Humboldt will be listening to this.
Keep on keeping on, Humboldt. You're doing just great, I think. You're in a wonderful position for climate change. This isn't too bad. You know, we had a nice a possibility of water and temperature, so... You know, and get ready for the newcomers who are going to be fleeing from, you know, from all kinds of disasters and stuff in the rest of the world and the interior.
So we'll find a way to accommodate everybody.
There you go. Yeah. Be kind, Humboldt. Welcome everyone. You know, keep on keeping on.
All right. You've listened this far. And for that, we thank you. We want to thank Richard Evans for Zooming with us and just sharing a little bit about his life and his thoughts and his views on the hippie dream that we are all continuing to benefit from here in Humboldt. Let's start a farm, Steph.
Yeah. Sounds easy to me.
Commune. I guess more is not could you do, like, imagine if you had
anything on the commune.
Well, right. Imagine if you had a group of adults, just, you know, and like you have Ziggy, right? And so like now you have this village of like-minded weirdos to, you know, divide duties and to sing songs and make s'mores. And is that what it's about? Did I get it?
Yeah, I remember Richard mentioning that s'mores were
a real
big part of the Back to the Land movement.
Uh-huh. Sure.
Homegrown s'mores. Anyway, so thanks for listening, Humboldt. Be kind, and as Richard said, and keep on keeping on. Just keep on doing it. And also, yeah, that's it.
All right.
Bye, Andrew.
Oh, bye. Okay, Steph, we got one more of these Fat Bowl ads we are blessed to be able to do. I have the copy for it right here. You want to do it? Should we do this?
Yeah, of course. I'm so excited. I love Fat Bowl.
Okay, well, here's how this ad reads. It goes, "Hey, Humboldt, come down to Fat Bowl store at 1618 G Street, Arcata, and check out their new designs. They have clothing for men and women, and they maintain a clean and healthy store."
Oh, well, that's... Good
aggression. I think like that's a wink, wink. Like, hey, we're trying to not have COVID in our store. That's how I read that. Okay, but anyway, come check out deals on disc golf equipment, art supplies, gifts, and accessories, and 25% off on all smoking supplies. Which I think they're talking about weed. You can't say that. I think this is for a radio ad, but this is a podcast, so we can just say weed.
We can say weed all day long, baby.
Come get your weed smoking supplies.
What, are you not allowed to say weed on the radio? Whatever. Anyway. Well, you know,
okay. If you're interested in branding or merchandise for your business, their custom printing services will have you covered. Get your brand on t-shirts, hats, hoodies, lighters, keychains, or just about anything else you can think of. That's good. I could think of a lot.
I could, but not right now.
But not right now. Okay. Fat Bowl, again, located on G Street in Arcata, across from Northtown Coffee. Fat Bowl is a local, you know him, you love him. Go give him pay him a visit and tell him that Stephanie sent you.